Hello and welcome to this episode of the Sprint Podcast. It's another special this week as we interview John McElroy. John was Rally's editor of Rally XS back in the day and as such was involved in the 2001 season and the surrounding era in a major way. Just some great stories throughout the chat and we'll be covering San Remo on next week's podcast, so keep an eye out for that. Talk to you then. So with me we have John McElroy. For those of you who remember Rally XS, John was Rally's editor at the time for that magazine, which was kind of an up-and-coming publication. We've mentioned it previously on the podcast. We absolutely love that magazine. It was just a really kind of a stylish look into the sport at the time. There was brilliant photography and some brilliant features and rally reports and things like that. So welcome along, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so John, like you've obviously got a pretty long career in motoring journalism in general at this stage. You've done work for Motorsport News and Autosport and a number of other publications as well. So do you want to give us just a little bit of background about yourself and how you came into being interested in the sport?
Mainly through my father. He was actually more into motorcycle racing, watching it. He wasn't a biker, but watching it and... I got hooked on cars when I was about 5 or 6. Just a next door neighbour took me to the King's Hall to the Ulster Motor Show. And then, as you know yourself, if you're in Ireland and you want to go and watch some motorsport, I mean, okay, there is some circuit racing, of course, but generally speaking, it's rallying. And I grew up in Banbridge, which is in good country for plenty of stages in the circuit of Ireland, the Ulster, and that sort of thing. And also, it's Kenny McKinstry country too. So that got me hooked, and then my dad, we had a sort of an agreement going whereby I would pester him in public in front of my mother to take me to the motorcycles to go and watch the motorbikes, which he would reluctantly agree to, and he would take me, and then he got to watch the bikes, and then as a thank you to that, he would take me and watch the rallies, and then we. I was suggested to go to rallies and rallycross events, circuit racing at Kirkeston, European rallycross down at Mondello. I think I got a fairly average grade in one of my GCSEs because it was the day before the mathematics exam or something like that, I think. So that was that. And then I took an interest in writing from about 11 or 12. Ian Linus, a good journalist from Northern Ireland, helped me a fair bit in the early days and lucked it into did my university degree, and I was, and actually stopped reading. I'd read Motoring News for many, many years, and I stopped reading it just when I was at college. And then I went home back home to Northern Ireland, and a good friend of mine, a fella next door that I used to chat to about rallying, just pulled me to one side one day and says, "Here, they're looking for a rally journalist." And that was that. I applied and got it, and there were three rally journalists at Motoring News at the time, and I was the lower rung, the bottom rung. And then by the spring of the following year, so that was weird. My first one was the Cambrian Rally. And then the following year, which was an autumn event, it was October. And that would have been 1995. So my first World Championship event, technically, I was reporting on some classes, but I did report on Colin, the Colin McRae title of the year, and did end up at the bar with them all that evening, as you do. The following year, the middle guy, a guy called Robert Hearn, decided he was going to go off and do Formula One. So that I did both. Jobs for a while. I think I did about 16 or 17 weekends on the trot because I was covering 4 national championships. And then at the end of that year, Haymarket bought Motoring News. David Williams, who was the top lead and the top ever probably rally journalist, decided he was going to go freelance. And I was given one rally in the WRC to prove that I could do WRC reports. And that was Catalunya 96, which Colin won. With Derek Ringer, and they also launched the World Rally Car Impreza and the World Rally Car Escort, and basically I managed to not screw up, so they decided I could do the WRC from that point on, and then I did WRC for part-time for MN to get my experience up the next couple of years. Then Autosport came knocking. I liked the fact that I read Autosport 2, and I liked the fact that it was a bit more glossy and the photography looked better, and I thought that appealed to me too, so I went and did that for a few years. And then you mentioned Rally XS. What happened was that David Richards and ISC decided that they wanted a magazine to really help promote the rally Shell World Rally Championship. And they worked with Haymarket on the concept. And that was that. And quite wisely, actually, Haymarket, I probably thought at the time, because I was cocksure myself, that I would probably end up being made editor of this, because I was the most senior rally journalist in the company at the time. And quite wisely, they decided that would be a really bad idea. So they made me rallies editor, and a guy called Andrew Goldby came in from Autosport. He was deputy editor in Autosport at the time. And Andrew and I, still friends today, and had a great time doing it. But he was very good to work with, because he just had that. He wasn't quite so bobble-hatted, so he was able to take a step back and work towards what was a sort of a new vision for the championship. They were really trying to build up the personalities and to build these guys into stars, and they wanted as much background and lifestyle that they could get. And you have to remember, of course, you were writing for an audience that was very much very varied, more varied than before probably, where there were some casual fans who were picking it up on mainstream television and so forth. So it was definitely a more lifestyle type of creation, and you were having to be, just bear in mind, you were writing stuff for people who weren't necessarily totally clued up on what Group A was and Group B and what a time control was and that sort of stuff. You had to try and explain it to them a bit like that. So it was an interesting challenge to do Rally Access from. We were there right from the off as a launch team.
It definitely had a huge impact, like on guys like me, like all of us on the podcast. We were all roughly the same age. Like I was probably 10 or 11 when I first picked up Rally Access, just spotted in the local news agent. Had obviously been following, you know, rallying similar to you, grew up with it around me and things like that, and was always mad into Irish rallying. But like, this was the first, I suppose, real proper exposure to the WRC scene, because it was on our terrestrial television network as well. And then you had this magazine as well. As you said there, they were trying to build the drivers of the stars, and it absolutely worked, in my opinion, because, you know, we're still talking about them to this day. They were proper household names, you know, in the UK and overseas as well. And they were, to us anyway, they were proper heroes. So I definitely think it achieved that aim.
It fitted in with a different style of, you know, it wasn't just the magazine, of course. The way the television was produced was different. Took a different twist on it. There was more. You would suddenly get two-thirds of the way through, I don't know, 1 hour report, and there might be a 5 minute segment on what somebody else does, how somebody goes mountain biking in the spring near their home, which was very different from what had gone before. But it was all designed to try and build these names to give you more personality. And it wasn't universally popular, you know, but even within the WRC service park, you know, there were obviously people who liked a very traditional approach to these things, and this was, it was seen as a bit lightweight sometimes, and it was, for me personally, was an interesting challenge, because I'd come from two very granular, you know, you want to tell a lovely story in motor news and autosport, but fundamentally, you know, you are getting into things like what tire choices and what, you know, what dampers do they have and little minutiae, and a very factual report basing as well. And all of a sudden, it was, for me as a journalist, it was a very big challenge to move across to having to write about, I don't know, people's lifestyle and trying to grasp them as personalities to a much greater extent. So it was a really, very enjoyable time, and obviously a great period to be involved in the championship. There was a lot of promotion behind it, a lot of money behind it, big manufacturer involvement, great cars, great drivers. It was a phenomenal era.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, as you said there, when you were writing about, you know, drivers' personalities and stuff like that, it was almost kind of following the template that, I suppose, some of the F1 mags or the football mags even did, where they gave you the insight into their lives outside of rallying. You know, I just remember one thing you did with Armin Schwartz inside in his apartment in Vienna or something, was it?
It was up in the... It was in Bavaria somewhere, I think. I flew into Munich, I remember that much. And I can remember it was pretty snowy, and Armin had something like an RS4 or some sort of S4 Avant, something four-wheel drive anyway, I remember that much. And I had a Ford Ka rental, because we were just driving back to the airport the next day. And the snow was coming down pretty heavily, I remember, as we went over the hills into Armin's, this village, this town that Armin had an apartment in. And he was so, I mean, he obviously realised there were no turnoffs in this room. And he hammered on ahead. And I remember he got there so early, he was able to park up at the junction. He came over a Brava Hill and there was a T-junction into this town. And he was able to pull up there just to wait for me to come over the brow of this hill and lose it completely. And he knew exactly what was going to happen. And sure enough, I did. At fairly low speed, it must be said, but I did slide sideways down with this Audi sitting there with Armin. I could see Armin laughing his head up with all that.
Looking enough to care, sharp enough care, or didn't?
Yeah. There was enough snow, it just sort of nudged into the bank and, you know, at the far side of the junction. And luckily, nothing had been coming along the route either. But yeah, those sort of features were. I enjoyed them because the people side of it always interested me, and the mental makeup of some of these guys. Even now, you know, the mental makeup of some of the guys, and some competition drivers, rally drivers or racing drivers you speak to, they might be long retired. They could be 15, 20 years retired. And yet they can't put it down. They can't admit something went wrong, or they can't admit they made a mistake, or they can't regret anything. Whereas there are others who will speak quite candidly about wrong choices they made, or it doesn't bother them, it's water off a duck's back. And I find that really interesting, that some were so intense and others were so laid back, and yet on 40 kilometres of, you know, gravel road, or really, you know, there could be fractions of a second between them in different cars. I thought that was remarkable.
Did you find, I suppose, in during that era, the professionalism was, you know, at a higher level compared to where it had been previously, or was it kind of much the same? Because I know we look at the guys today, you know, look back in the 80s, you had guys like Timo Salonen trying to smoke his way through a pack of cigarettes on a stage if he had the chance. So I suppose you look at the likes of Burns and Granholm and stuff like that, and Loeb, look, you know, did you notice kind of an increase in the professionalism around this era?
I would say not when I was doing it. I think I was much, by the time I started doing it, which was being, say, end of 96 into 97, it was already heading much more towards the era we have today compared with, you know, as you said, mid-80s. So I suppose if I went these days on a WRC run, would I notice a difference, for example, on a Sunday night? Is there a smaller party going on than there used to be? Certainly you would have seen, in my time, you would still have seen drivers in local restaurants. You would have seen them on the Sunday evening. There was invariably a party somewhere in some disco or nightclub. And they would have been there going quite hard at it. And we all did, frankly. And there were certain, you know, there was a great sort of hack pack amongst the British journalists. David Williams, probably the ringleader at the time, but Jerry Williams in the Daily Mail would have been going to it. Martin Sharp from Car and Car Conversions would have been around somewhere. You know, David Evans was coming on the scene then too, you know, and there were photographers too. So you were dining out quite nicely and having a good time of it every night, even during the event, if you possibly could, because the key really was in the internet was coming on, but it wasn't the be-all and end-all. So, yes, you probably had to file a nightly report for Autosport, let's say, I think, or WRC.com or something I was doing at the time too. But that would be it, and it would only be a few hundred words, and you'd be done. But the much bigger task came, really, at the end. You had 4 days to prepare a report that would probably be 2,000 to 3,000 words long. And so that allowed you that bit of freedom. So I imagine these days, with the fact that it's minute by minute, and you've got to be right on it with a tweet or watching a bit of footage. You know, I sat down in my office at the start of Monty this year. Got into the office, was sitting having my morning croissant and a cup of coffee, and put on the phone live, and just flicked on 5 seconds before Tanak's off. And you think, how on earth, if you're reporting on that, how do you keep up with that? Pace-wise, it's a fair... That bit has changed from the journalistic perspective, and I'm guessing from the driver perspective, they're probably even more trained than, as you say, because the cars are that much more physical. But what I don't know is whether they still... I couldn't speak as to whether they still work hard, play hard sort of thing. I'm not sure how that goes on in the evenings. But in comparison with the 1980s, I was already much more towards that, you know, Burns, he was already an athlete. Lou was an athlete, had been an athlete, and then turned to rallying. So, and there was a slight difference in generation as well, because there was a good generation mix in 01 around that era as well, because you still had Kankinen was still knocking around. Carlos Sainz was probably, you know, he was still in his pomp, but, you know, when you bear in mind he'd been winning rallies in, you know, 1990, he was already 10 years on from then. Francois Delucre wasn't necessarily the youngest guy in the service park either. There was a few more of those slightly older style drivers. So there was an interesting mix going on, definitely.
As you said there, with the older generation and the younger generation coming in, you had that really just nice mix where the older guys were still, you know, they mightn't have been at their absolute peak, but they were still very competitive. Like, as you said, Sainz had been winning for so long at this point, but he was still one of the four guys at the end of the year in with a shot at the title, and he did it again in 03, yeah, which is just testament to the kind of professional he was. He was just a phenomenal driver. And he got voted the WRC.com's greatest driver of all time.
I saw that a few weeks ago, and I thought it's hard to disagree with that. I suppose the one I might put forward that I'm very fond of is Kankinen. Only the fact that he didn't really win on tarmac would stand against Juha. And he came close. But the fact that he won a title in Group B, he won titles in Group A, he won title for Peugeot, he won title for different manner, you know, Lancia, and was still winning in a World Rally Car. I thought, you know, in terms of breadth of, you know, there's a good 15-year span there, where 16 years where Juha was absolutely right amongst the top dogs. In terms of professional application and just charisma and intensity, Carlos is very hard to argue against. Yeah, incredibly professional, charming, intense kind of guy. I do remember I got bollocked by him for my first report, which the 4PR guy, he tore a strip off me at the start of the Swedish for something I'd said in my report about the mountain in 97. And the 4PR guy, Paul Evans, just took me to one side, put an arm around me and said, "That happens to everyone, don't worry. Everyone has to be there at least once." And yet, you know, he would always return your calls. He would always pick up the phone where possible. And it was actually a really good human being underneath it all with Carlos too. Yeah, I remember being charmed by him when I was editor of Autosport briefly after I finished doing WRC. I went back from Rally Access to Autosport and then ultimately edited for 18 months or 2 years and had the Autosport Awards 1 year. And I was determined to get Carlos to come because we'd always tried to get him to come in the past and failed. Got him to come. He brought his wife over and he was on, say, the editor's table. So he was there with Felipe Massa and a bunch of other guys were on the same table with us. And with his wife. And as they announced, I remember in the room, they always used to say who was in the room with the Autosport Awards. Steve Ryder would say, "We're joined by so-and-so." And there'd be polite applause. With Carlos, the whole room stood up and gave him a standing ovation. And I remember Stirling Moss coming over on his walking frame to meet him, even as the room was applauding. The only problem had been that Carlos's wife had chosen that very moment to go to the toilet. And then I just remember laughing my head off at Carlos as she came back in, and Carlos was saying to me, "Oh, you missed it. You missed it." Like, you know, the whole room stood up. "Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. Stirling Moss came over. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You and your toes stood up." And you thought, the Carlos I knew in a service park could explode at that point. But in fact, he was laughing his head off. You know, and I thought, what a lovely guy. And very hard to argue against, for sure. But you're right. And he was still, those guys were still very much in the mix. I mean, Carlos had he stayed in the mix in that 2001 season. Didn't win a rally, but string of podium finishes was a remarkable achievement that year. It was such a cutthroat season.
He was unlucky, you know, on a couple of events, and you know, Ford had a couple of reliability issues throughout the year. Like, you know, if Carlos hadn't retired in the Acropolis and the last stage, he would have had 6 points easy. There was a couple of other events like that as well where he missed out on points, and it could have been a different story at the end of the year. We've said it a couple of times throughout the series. It was almost like a championship that nobody wanted to win at some points, because
for sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look, you know, Burnsy won that championship with one win. Which ultimately, but we're not ruining your plot here, but I mean, for future episodes. But,
Spoiler alert,
you have to put a klaxon in there or something.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Burnsy wins this championship with one win. Now, that's not to say he doesn't deserve to win it. Far from it. But, you know, Colin went through that extraordinary run in the middle of the season. But you're right. I mean, Ford's reliability was flaky still at that point. And he had a lot of retirements to go along with it. And you're right. You're absolutely right. At times it did feel like a championship that nobody wanted to win. Especially people like, you know, Grunholm, the previous year, had obviously won for Persia. I wouldn't have been at all surprised. I mean, that was still a relatively young team and a relatively young car, that 206. It wouldn't have surprised me entirely, at all, frankly, if Marcus had gone on to utterly dominate 2001. Which he did. He did it in 2002. It was a year out. But you know, they had niggles through 2001 as well.
The signs were there towards the latter part of the year, as we'll see in the next few episodes as well. And we saw it already in Finland. The 206 was, you know, probably the quickest package. It just didn't have the reliability. We saw it pretty much self-destruct on nearly every rally for the first half of the season. Granholm had, like, was it 4 points or 7 points or something after 8 rounds? It was just catastrophic for him. Won in Finland. And then if you look at his times towards the end of the year, his results, he actually wasn't a million miles away in terms of points compared to the championship winner, just purely because of the last couple of performances that he put in. So again, that, and then it was a kind of an ominous sign for what was to happen in 2002, you know, which I'm not sure if we'll do a full series on it, but we'll definitely touch it on at some point.
Well, you can wrap it up by July, cause I think, or, you know, early September, because that's what he did.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so that was a very dominant performance in 2002. You're right. I mean, if he'd got away with a couple of results in the first half of the season, you know, one, he probably would have been absolutely, I mean, you know, very threatening indeed with the speed that he had in Australia and GB to threaten for the overall title, for sure.
It was amazing how he just kind of locked into the 206 the 2000 title was a little bit surprising. And you could argue that maybe Burns should have won in 2000. They had arguably the best car, that P2000 was just a weapon of a thing. For various reasons, they didn't actually put it together in the end. But like, Granholm was this kind of big, tall guy. How he managed to fall himself into that 206, I'll never know. But he'd been kind of crashing Toyotas there with a long time, and all of a sudden he got into this Peugeot and wiped
just
the floor.
Clicked.
Yeah, it was amazing. Just wiped the floor with the likes of Delacour and stuff. And Auriel, Auriel was a broken man in 01.
Yeah, and Didier. Everything had to be right for Didier. He had to have the feeling, and there was a lot of internal sort of French squabbles going on. Things about what gearbox it had. There was a constant battle. I'm not sure whether it was even 01. I think it might have been where they were constantly battling about whether to have a 5-speed or a 6-speed gearbox. And with Marcus, you know, I mentioned earlier about things being water off a duck's back. Marcus was one of those guys. Astonishing, I mean, a phenomenal competitive streak in him. But personality-wise, soft as wet as hot butter. I mean, there were times when he was, particularly where there were battles with Burnsy. I'm not necessarily saying this is 01, it might have been 2000. And they were already trying to big this up, and the TV pack would descend upon the in control, and Jeremy Hart would have been doing his best to try and ramp up the drama a bit, and Marcus, you know, Richard says he's going to beat you, you know. And Marcus would give some off-the-cuff answer about, yeah, well, I'm going to beat him. As soon as the pack moved on, I'd, you know, wander over with my notepad to see what he wanted to say. But he would grab me by the arm and say, That didn't sound bad, did it? I don't want it to sound arrogant. People don't think I'm having a go at Richard, do they? But he was putting the thing on entirely just for the TV cameras. And actually, as a bloke, he really couldn't have cared less. He was absolutely one of those ones that seemed, at that stage anyway, impervious to anything that was going on around him. But yeah, you're quite correct. When he was in the zone and that thing clicked with the 206, as it did a lot over those two or three seasons, dynamite. Absolute dynamite. And I'm very unlucky, you know, he really desperately wanted to win a tarmac rally in the 206. And unless someone's going to write in and correct me, I don't think it happened. And partly down to a few other foibles of the car and his own, earlier on, his own driving technique as he got the hang of it. And then obviously Peugeot already had some pretty good tarmac drivers. You know, if the car was fit and at the front end of the pack, Panizzi could probably take it that extra couple of seconds to get it over the line.
Yeah.
So he was unlucky to not win a rally like that on tarmac anyway.
I think the only seal surface rally, if you can even call it that, he won
was probably Ireland.
Monty in 06, I think. And that was after Loeb ended up going out on day one. And
that's right, rally the Focus.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. He didn't win one of the Peugeot, I don't think. And he desperately wanted to, because he could see around him the French, obviously, it was a weird dynamic in that team, because Corrado Provera, the team boss, was such a brilliant, volatile individual. The emotion would flow in different directions, and you could almost sense it coming to a tarmac rally, that Marcus's car was just not being looked at quite as much. Not they were neglecting it, you know, in terms of technical prowess. It was as well prepared as anything else there. But just the focus of the team was somewhere else. And I knew that bugged him. Somewhere deep down inside him, he would have loved to have stuffed one over Panizzi on tarmac.
He came quite close. Like, if you look at his times throughout the year, he never quite, as we saw, actually put it together into a full result as such, but he definitely showed flashes where he was quicker than Panizzi or Auriel over a given stage or whatever. Now, Panizzi then, on dry tarmac, just as you said, had the edge. But that was Panizzi's thing. He could do dry tarmac, he couldn't really do much else. So again, though, it just shows how competitive Granholm was, that still kind of bugged him.
And the loves, and Marcus was the loveliest. You talk about rally excess, and Marcus, of course, played. It was a feature we did in the very first issue where I arranged really with him directly to follow him on his first day as champion. So he told me what flights he was on, and that was about the sum total of it. And I think we got a snapper to come with us, and we booked a couple of cheap hotel rooms in Helsinki, and there was occasional that a mobile phone contact down the M4 from Wales in the morning, and got to Heathrow, and Marcus found me and said, you know, when we get to Helsinki, don't go through passport control, you come with me. And I'm like, okay. And he had arranged a bit of a VIP reception thing planned, but it was a little suite, I suppose you'd call it, for VIPs. With a few choice Finnish nibbles and a couple of some bottles of champagne, and he took us all into that completely. There was no PR, no Peugeot activity at all. The only thing he'd done was he got the woman from Peugeot Finland to organise an extra car to take us to whatever hotel we were staying, and then we got invited to his manager was involved in an ice hockey team, as I recall. So was it the Hartwall Arena, I think it would have been? It was a big ice hockey rink in Helsinki. And they had the party in there. And again, answered every question I wanted. Introduced me to everyone from his manager to his local undertaker who'd driven the bus down from his hometown. And you know, Marcus was an outcast, don't forget, in Finnish rallying terms. Marcus's first language was Swedish, because he's from that part of Finland. So he wasn't part of the Jockey, Timo Jockey stable. He wasn't part of that fraternity at all. So this bunch of Misfits. I'd all come down in a very odd-looking bus from to celebrate with them. And the last thing I can remember is Marcus just taking me to one side and saying, "Have you got everything you need now? Because I'd quite like to get drunk. I want to celebrate the fact I'm champion." But he, bless him, you know, he'd stayed on his best behaviour to answer all those questions. And that was the kind of guy he was. And he's high standards. From what I can tell, from those who still speak to him, hasn't changed a bit. And, you know, he was on a good salary at Peugeot. He never invested it in it. He never bought a Ferrari or anything like that. You know, he had a Peugeot 806. Quite liked it. Had it for taking the kids around. You know, he didn't buy an island, I think. He bought a little one of those little summer house islands that the Finns are so fond of. But he didn't buy a new boat. He leased a new boat. He leased a better boat. It was more sensible. Better use his money. A very, charming guy. Really charming.
Brilliant. You mentioned earlier on in our chat just about the sections within the coverage where they kind of showed these clips into the driver's lifestyles or whatever. And I just remember, I think Grandin was painting his decking or something.
That would be right. That would be
it. That's part of his, and maybe on a tractor as well. That's brilliant. He always came across really well in interviews and stuff as well, even, you know, stage end interviews, which weren't really a feature as such at the time. They've obviously become a lot more kind of prominent since, but you know, he always gave, I think, what he was thinking, especially in the 307 days. You know, the frustration was palpable. There was no hiding it. So that's brilliant to hear. I guess another aspect of it, like, we look at the calendar now, you know, there's obviously a lot of long haul events. It's similar to the time. Like, your byline is on every Rally Access report from that year, and obviously subsequent years as well. Like, that's a lot of traveling. So what was that aspect like for you?
You can't complain about it too much. It was a dream job, but it was harder doing it than it was doing the weekly magazines, I would say. There was an initial blast, and Andrew would probably admit this too, but where I think the pair of us sat in our backsides for about 6 weeks when we started, because we thought we were so used to doing weekly deadlines, that suddenly having a bi-monthly was, you know, this is easy. We can do all this in a fortnight. Then as the season went on, we realised that wasn't going to be the case, because you were doing, obviously, as you say, the full championship, but you know, a lot of stuff to fit in between it, so that the lifestyle stuff added an awful lot to the schedule. I didn't by any means do all the features in AliExcess. There were lots of great writers who bought in content from. But things like, you know, for example, you mentioned that Armin feature that was probably between two events, and it might have been otherwise a fortnight where I would have been at home. And instead I was probably in Germany for 48 or 72 hours. Other features took four or five days at a time sometimes. So that was a bit more of a challenge. I think I certainly it was one of those years I totted up, and it was well in excess of 90 flights in the year I did, and I can assure you all they were firmly in the back of cattle class the whole way there and the whole way back. And those long hauls were great, you know, jet lag and stuff, you just fought past it really. They were great events to go on. I mean, who wouldn't want to go and look at Rally Australia or New Zealand? And that's before you mentioned Safari, which is just still one of my all-time favourite things to go and do. Just as a journalist, the fact that literally anything can happen on that event. And I saw some great, even service activity with, you know, I stood and applauded mechanics just because they put, there was one, certainly remember one time with Colin, where they virtually rebuilt the entire wing of the car because the top mount had been ripped out and everything, and they just rebuilt it and got him out all this minute. And how could you not stand there and applaud that? You know, but that sort of thing happened. It can happen anywhere in rallying, I suppose, but the odds were always slightly higher in Kenya, that's for sure.
It was almost par for the course in Kenya, really, that there was going to be, you know, massively increased the amount of activity. I think Skoda even ran out of shock absorbers that year, didn't they? There was something about having to rebuild shocks throughout the event just to basically get them going. And it worked out really well for them because they actually got their only, to date anyway, unless they join again in the future, their only podium at World Championship level.
Which yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, the suspension took a massive pounding on the Safari, and I certainly, even the year that Colin won his first one in 97, I think Kenneth Erickson retired quite early on in that event, and I seem to remember that they were, by the end of it, they were using not only Colin's shocks rebuilt, but also all of Kenneth's rebuilt. And frankly, if Kenneth hadn't retired, they would probably have run out of shocks. I mean, it could be that brutal.
Yeah,
I know that. I remember Armin was again a lovely guy, real professional, and that meant an enormous amount to the Czechs. Who it would be incorrect to say that they didn't turn up to win, but they knew they were doing things on a much smaller budget and a much more modest scale than, for example, Subaru or the French. When they could do something like that, it meant a huge amount to them. And in fact, that season was actually really tough for them too, because in Argentina they'd had the really funny accident, or funny as a strange freak accident, involving one of the engineers who, I guess you've covered this, but was badly injured when a fire truck tipped over on the entrance to service. I can remember exactly. I can picture it happening in front of me. It was a remote press office just the other side of the room, and I remember hearing the siren coming, looking up from my laptop and seeing this thing just topple, and then seeing the dust fly up and obviously the commotion. So it had been a very tough season for them. For them, that was a major event to go into Argentina, and they withdrew their cars from that rally. They were damaged, and everybody in the team was so upset about it. So to get a result like that on Safari was just terrific for them.
Yeah, it was brilliant for them. And like, Armin had finished fourth in the Monte, which was a massive achievement as well. He actually wasn't too far away from a podium at the end, which was seriously impressive. I know the Monte is obviously a bit of a lottery, but like, it just is testament to how good a driver Armin was as well. And we kind of have a habit of kind of, in a loving way, taking the piss out of the Octavia.
He drove that thing like a Mark II.
He did.
He absolutely ragged it everywhere. Yeah. Around that time, or slightly, it probably was slightly after Rally Access time, I went to Germany to what is now the Eifel Rally Festival, but at the time was the Down. It was just called the Down Rally, where it was quite early in the days of Slowly Sideways, Reinhard Klein's, the photographer Reinhard Klein's organization of Group B and the vintage rally car enthusiast, and had a number of runs actually with various people, in fact, including Reinhard. He took me around the Nürburgring. Reinhard has a very nice 6R4 and took me around the Nordschleife. But in the middle of all this, someone dragged me to one side and said, "Oh, Armin wants a word." And Armin offered me to sit in his Delta S4, which he had bought. It was an ex-Recalde car, Jose Recalde car, which I think he turned into full tarmac specification. I would never be as aware, acutely aware of my own mortality as I was in that vehicle. You get in, your head's hitting the ceiling. No, I think I did have a crash helmet on, no overalls, t-shirt and jeans. And, for the vast majority of Slowly Sideways people, that's fine. Or it was then. They probably do wear overalls now, but back then that was fine because they really weren't pootling around. This Armin doesn't do pootling. You get in, your head's hitting the ceiling in this thing. Armin, why is my head hitting the ceiling? Why is the seat so bloody high? Yeah, because the fuel tank's under it. Okay, thanks. That's all. I've got one over here too. Thanks, Armin. And then... we caught, it was electric, the thing was phenomenal. We caught the course opening, or the spectator safety car. We were running whatever number zeroed car we were running, we caught this thing. And I can still picture it. It was a maroon Galant VR4. And we came over the brow of the hill, and this thing was ambling down the middle of the road with its hazard, you know, the flashing lights on, the sirens going. And he caught sight of us in the mirrors, in his rearview mirror, and veered off the course. And I can still picture, I mean, nothing did happen, but I can still picture it as we went past him, and Armin shifted up in this delta. This gallant was bouncing across the grass towards the spectator enclosure, completely out of control. And I thought, this is brilliant. We've managed to cause the spectator control car to crash into the spectators because we're going so damn fast. And he'd given him like easily 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes, you know, and he'd still caught him. Yeah, he did. I think he got rid of the delta in the end and he got an S1 Quattro up. But yeah, he was. That was one of those ones that probably did come about through Rally XS, actually. Spending time with people like that, going to see his apartment and spending a day with him. You just got to know them better, didn't you? Spending time with people.
Brilliant. Yeah, he was a phenomenal pilot, and like the Delta S4 is, in my mind anyway, the scariest rally car ever built. Just everything about it is terrifying. It just looks like it's, you know, trying to spit itself off the road every corner it comes to. But we'll definitely do an episode on that era in the future. I've been close to a couple of them at Rally Legend in Italy. Obviously, haven't had a passenger spin in one or whatever, but I made a point of touching them when we were at a start line. Just made a point of just like touching them because we were that close. They were obviously just on the start line waiting to go. So I was like, I'll never see this again. I was like watching an S4, a couple of S4s take off in the Italian hills at like 11:30 at night with about 1,000 Italians around the place, all going mad. Oh, it was wonderful. So I can only.
Yeah, Armin was a great driver. He was European champion, Armin Schwarz. So
96, wasn't it?
Yeah, 96. So, you know, so he was a good fit for Skoda. And as you say, there might have been a slight bit of Mickey taking going on about the Octavia. It was their biggest selling car. It was the car that. That car meant an enormous amount to them as a brand, as I've subsequently learned, because obviously that's what I do now. I write about regular cars rather than motorsports, and I know the guys at Skoda quite well, and I've got a bit of history with them and stuff. And I know that, how much that car meant to them. Not necessarily the rally car, but the Octavia, just as a standalone product for them to bring out, was very important to them. So it was natural they were going to use that car as the rally car. Was it ideal? No. But they did, but they probably even slightly overachieved with it in some ways.
In terms of its the Octavia's fan base relative to its results and competitiveness, it's definitely one of the top. We're all massively fond of it, even the noise, yeah. The way it was sideways ever, as you've said, even like in Bruno Thierry's hands and private guys like Emil Triner, who would have done a couple of rallies for Skoda back in the day as well. But like, it just seemed to be the way the car was driven. It was a real throwback to the kind of Group A stuff. It just had to be thrown around. But that's brilliant. I suppose like a big element to Rally XS, as we've said, you know, it was trying to appeal to the broader church, for want of a better word. You did a lot of features, and it wasn't just the lifestyle stuff. Like you would have done some pretty decent, you know, test drives and stuff like that with the top guys at the time. Like you had a test with Delacour, and you sat in with Loeb in the Saxo at the time. Like, you know, these are, looking back at it now, that's amazing. Like, so can you tell us a little bit about those tests?
Well, I remember I remember both of them. The Delacour test, there'd been some sort of the Delacour test. For those of you who know, we went to Torsby or near Torsby and did joined the tire test. The idea was they wanted me to try and explain what it was like to sit in a car on snow. And there was some sort of breakdown in communications, and I arrived with a guy called Ian Dawson, who was the photographer. Was one of the guys that we sort of brought in. We tried to experiment with different photographers. And Ian was a very experienced car snapper. A little bit jumpy on it, maybe. And we arrived in Torsby and to discover that no one had told the team we were coming. And it was only the fact that George Black was there. George was the tire engineer at M-Sport. And who and I, obviously, bored senseless at various in-controls over the years, grabbing tire coupons and stuff off him. And he gave me this quizzical look as we arrived in the hotel bar the night before, saying, what are you doing here? And it took quite some persuasion that we were going to bolt a camera rig on the side of this test car, which still had a number of days to do. And they were very nervous about doing any photography, mounting anything on the car, because they only had no additional supplies of glass. So given that it's minus 15, minus 20, the glass is already a little bit more fragile. And I can remember the screams as Ian attached a photography rig to the side of the Focus, and then you could see the whole thing flexing. Francois, meanwhile, was thoroughly bored most of the day. There was a lot of setup work and what have you, geometry work. I think it might have been the first day of the test. He spent most of his day just sitting with his feet in the... They'd lit a campfire, and he just had his boots sitting in the fire, throwing cans of brake cleaner in it, seeing how long it took them to explode and that sort of stuff. And I knew Francois... I mean, obviously, I reported on him for 2 or 3 years before that point. I wouldn't claim to have known him that well. I did speak some French, but there was obviously still a language barrier there. And also, he's quite intimidating, even at the best of times. And at the end of the day, they said, fine, we can squeeze you in, you can do this run. Again, t-shirt and jeans, grabbed a lid from somewhere. And it was too late to think of it. The light was fading by the time we actually did the run that I wrote about. I think we did some photography before then, but at low speed. But to actually get the angry run, it had to come up right at the end of the day. Light was fading. They hadn't time to put the lamp pod on, so we did it just on regular full beam. And Francois turned to me as I got in the car and said, so this is your first time in a World Rally Car? And in my haste, because everything was a bit all of a rush, I just very dismissively said, oh God, no, I've been in loads of these. And the look of annoyance, fury on his face as he clunked it into gear. And I thought, oh God, that was a mistake. And that is still, and I'm very, very lucky to have sat with quite a few of the top drivers just as ballast for stories and that sort of thing. That is in the top five, that run. Because for starters, you've got where I would normally break for corners, where a normal civilian would break for corners. Well, you're way beyond that. Then you've got the fact that he's going beyond where even he would break for corners, because he knows there's a snowbank to catch him, and he's overcommitting himself because he knows he'd get away with it. Then you've got to factor in the fact that he was pissed off as well. And it was at the end of the day, and he was bored, and he's got this snotty British journalist beside him. And it was and you'd know full beam, or you'd know spotlights. So you're coming up to crests, and utterly, I mean, he knew exactly where he was going. I had no idea. And we did, you know, whatever it was, 5 kilometres there and 5 kilometres back. And it was mind-blowing. And that's still absolutely in my top five rally car experiences. Never told him that. Loeb, you mentioned. So Loeb, I couldn't claim any credit for that story. The inspiration for it was frankly David Williams, who had been talking about this guy coming up through the ranks in French championship. And I pitched the idea to Andrew and took a bit of persuasion, because again, he was junior WRC, I think. He did the Corolla events the year before. I'm right on that, isn't it? In 2000.
Correct, yeah, he did. GFFSA brought him in the Corolla for a couple of rallies in 2000.
That's right. Yeah. So it still wasn't entirely straightforward to get the idea of doing the story. But in the end, we worked out that he was going to be testing in a place called Issoire, which is quite a very professional test track in France, which has a extensive asphalt bit, but also a good gravel course. And if I recall correctly, that it was because he was testing the Saxo for the 1000 Lakes. So he was doing tire testing for the 1000 Lakes. And we turned up, he still spoke, his English wasn't bad, but it was still pidgin. And he was not very confident either. He was quite shy. And on the same day, I was doing a joint slot. There was me, and then there was a team from some obscure analog satellite station we were turning up to do a lifestyle piece on, who, after about 20 minutes, turned around and said, well, he doesn't speak anywhere near enough English. He's useless. And went off to have lunch. They just abandoned him. Now, I knew Daniel Elena a little bit, again, from In Controls that I'd met him at. And again, I spoke just about enough. Daniel spoke even less English than Seb, actually, but I spoke enough French to get on with him. And Daniel, I was sort of trying to get a bit of atmosphere on the place. And I was thinking, I was scheduled to have a run with him in the car. A run. Anyway, as we chatted away, Daniel, after a while, turned to me and said, you know, he's only doing tar testing. I said, yeah. So the only thing that's really important is that it's consistent. The weight has to be consistent. Okay. So, I mean, if you got into the passenger seat, I could just stand here and smoke cigarettes, which is really what I want to do anyway. So, all right. So I did run. For that feature, I must have done 45 or 50 kilometers, run after run after run, with Seb in that Saxon. And Issoire was very sandy. So I remember him, I think I did include it in the story, actually. He was a hairpin in it, which was getting increasingly badly rutted. And it would bog down occasionally, there would be dust everywhere. And I remember him looking across and laughing, going, c'est comme safari, c'est comme safari. It's like the safari. Even in that really bad surface, he was still clipping every apex to within a few millimeters every time. Monotonous brilliance. That would be in the top. Very different car, very different circumstances, but that would obviously be in the top five as well. And such a nice guy that even I never reported in any of his championships. I was gone by the time I reported on some of his early wins, but not. By the time he won his title, I stopped doing it. But even now, if he saw me in a room, he'd still come across and say hello and chat. And that, I think, from what I can tell, he hasn't changed very much at all. He's still a kid that fiercely competitive. He was quite aggrieved that there was more than one Find a Superstar program in France that passed him by. And in fact, if it hadn't been for local backers, he wouldn't have even managed to get to Rally Jeune or to the Citroën program. So, but that day, just, you know, he didn't bat an eyelid either. He didn't care as long as somebody was sitting in the car with him. It meant that Daniel could smoke, and we chatted away. Yeah, that was a really enjoyable feature. Very enjoyable. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's interesting to look at. We'll be covering San Remo in next week's episode. And I've watched it a couple of times recently, just brushing up on the knowledge and stuff like that. He puts in a phenomenal drive. And if you look at his progression through 2002, you know, how he got on tarmac, and you can see the pace is building and building and building on gravel. To be where he was at that point in his career versus the guys that were, you know, at the top at the time, it was a sure sign that he was going to be just a superstar. Like, even if you look at his performances in the JWRC in 2001, I think we touched on it in a couple of rallies. He just dominated. I think he won Finland by like 5 minutes or something. Yeah. So your tire testing endeavours there, John, definitely.
I can only imagine he thought the handling was an awful lot better without my weight in it. So it was probably a revelation to him. That San Remo, that was the one in 2001, was that the one that ended and it was like really heavy rain on the final day? Is that right?
That's the one.
Actually, Panizzi had like about half a minute on him. And he started, Seb did take some time out of Panizzi, I think, on that final day. And for a little, it wasn't a wobble as far as Gilles was concerned. But it was, you know, everyone had thought, well, here, we're really going to find out whether how close to the edge this young guy is pushing it, because he'll be the first one to go off in those conditions if he's really right on it, on the limit. And then he wasn't. Yeah,
he was well within himself. And that was kind of a hallmark of Sebastian, that he was never, like, you probably count on one hand the amount of times he really turned it on 100%. He was just that bit ahead of everyone else, that he didn't need to be at his maximum. He was just so comfortable. Like that San Remo, as we'll see now next week, that was his first time in the Zara on a WRC event, but also his first ever time driving the car in the rain. He hadn't even tested in the wet.
No.
And there he was taking chunks at the time of Venezia on the final day. So, just a phenomenal talent and one of the superstars of the sport. Rally legend again. The last time we were there, 2017, they had a huge collection of the world champions there that year to commemorate Colin McRae.
Mm-hmm.
And if you saw the standing ovation that Loeb got, I mean, you had on the stage, I think I have a picture of it somewhere, but like, it was just phenomenal. He is a proper hero.
I think if anything, it's slightly upsetting that he didn't get more competition during his run. At the absolute peak of his powers, you're right. He drove a lot of his victories came at 90%, 95%. He didn't have to. That combination of him and the Citroën was so strong that he never had to. Well, never. He didn't have to extend himself as often as some others had to do. That's not a criticism of him, that's a criticism of the era, and it would have been great to have seen him really stretched more often, I think. Undoubtedly, he defined an era, Seb Loeb, for me. It was the epitome of the sophistication of suspension and transmission and so forth. He drove the car in a different way than the likes of certainly Colin, possibly even Carlos. And that was quicker, and the championship and rally driving as we know it today has was changed by Sebastian Loeb, I think.
Just looking at some of the other features at the time, there was a brilliant one. It wasn't actually from 2001, but it all ties into this era, and again, just something that you could never imagine happening these days. But you guys actually drove a Works Hyundai Accent WRC from Rally Catalunya back to the UK. I mean, take us through that. That must have just been a crazy experience.
Yeah, that was. That was definitely one of the things that couldn't happen virtually for any other magazine. I think it was the fact that we were semi-affiliated to the championship, and the manufacturers were all teed up and desperate to be seen to support it. And Andrew and I came up with this. It must have been a wild lunch. I can't remember how it even came about, but the pitch went in to a couple of manufacturers. I think the idea of driving a car back from a rally, and Hyundai said yes. And so it was Catalunya 2002. And the morning after the event finished, Andrew and I went to a workshop on the outskirts of Lloret de Mar. And there was Freddie Loix's car that had just finished the previous afternoon. Same clutch. Same brakes. They modified the map for it to run on slightly more conventional fuel. We had two mechanics, JT and Trevor, I think they were called. And Simon, JT and Simon. And they had a couple of Hyundai people carriers and a trailer. And the carriers were just full of bits. And the trailer was in case we didn't have the right bits. And off we went. And we spent 4 days living with that car. We drove it. I remember the gearbox had to be changed on the Pyrenees. And Freddie Loix, I knew Freddie quite well, and we got on very well. And Freddie just has a great sense of humor. And Freddie had bet me 10 beers that I wouldn't get as far as Paris. So there was certainly, I think the night before, but to give you an idea of how, the night before we got to Paris, we booked a hotel, one of the big chain hotels, and we in the booking stipulated, we need an area of the car park. We have something that's worth, £350,000 was roughly the estimate of a WRC in those days. We need to be able to block it in and so, and then quick phone check as we approached the town in question revealed the fact that hotel car park was completely full and they expected us to park this car out on the road. So in a huff, we decided we'd look for somewhere else. And not long after we went past it, was one of those little French auberges where there's like a gravel car park on one side of the road and then the other side of the road, right literally the doors on the road was this little auberge, family run hostel. And someone went, "That'll do." Shriek of brakes, and we went into this car park, and we boxed this Hyundai into the hedge at the back of the car park with the people carriers. And Anton Watts, the photographer, had his increasingly battered Clio rental car, which had about one working brake because he kept pulling the handbrake on motorways and stuff. Anyway, so I still remember this little kid who was the son of the family who just, you know, poked his face was pressed against the glass of the of his front room as this, you know, car just revving and popping and, you know, trying to get into this car park. So then we went to Paris. So we didn't, well, the following morning, that's the pretty long story. The following morning, we get to first fuel stop of the day, and one of the mechanics, I think it was JT, was under the bonnet. I said, "What are you doing there?" He says, "Oh, I'm just checking the fluid levels." I said, "Oh, fair enough." And then got back in the car, and it refused to fire up. And the two guys were saying, "Well, you know, we had this problem with a Michael Guest's car a few months back, and it could be the wiring loom gets a fault, and then that's it. If it's the wiring loom, forget it. We ain't got a wiring loom. There's no way we could change it. It's end of story. This could be it now." So I'm pacing around the outskirts. They're trying to fix this thing, and the phone rings, and it's Loïc's. "Hey, how are you getting on?" I said, "Yeah, well, you know, you picked the right time to call Freddie. You know, almost smell those 10 beers. But it looks like it's going to elude us because the thing's, oh, no, same as Michael Guest. Yeah, oh, the wiring, yeah, big problem." But he said, "Oh, I can fix your car for you, John." I said, no, "You don't understand, Freddie. JT and Simon are looking at it. It looks bad." He said, no, "You don't understand. The car doesn't start until I say so." Like, what? And I turned around and JT was smiling. And I was like, "Loïc, if this car starts, you're a dead man." And it was a complete stitch-up, absolute stitch-up. JT had just taken the coil off it. And I was so furious. And Andrew Golby certainly afterwards last says, "I've never seen you swearing so much down the telephone." Screaming down, and the fits of laughter from Freddie at the other end. And he said, "Hey, I tell you what," he said, "I'll make it up to you. If you make it back to Milton Keynes, I'll give you 20 beers. So that was fine. We got Andrew nearly got arrested in Paris driving the car around the Arc de Triomphe with the full lamp pod on. And the clutch was getting increasingly fragile towards the end, but they wanted us to visit Hyundai's headquarters in the UK, and it was a really hot day, and the motorways were all blocked, and it was late. It was sort of 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening when we got to Milton Keynes, if I recall correctly, the motorsport developments, and weren't even that many people left there. Actually, most of them had gone home, but did make it, and Freddie did pay up. So at Rally Australia that year, we went. I did not consume all 20 of them. We shared them out, but he did buy a round of 20 beers for everybody in the bar. But even now, Andrew lives very close to me here, and we'll see each other not as often as we'd like, but every 6 or 9 months, maybe for a curry. And we'll still look at each other and go, "Can you believe they gave us a World Rally car for 4 days to drive?" You know, there were bits where we drove it around. I remember at one point saying, let's drive it and find a school and see if we can show some kids, you know, they'll go mental for it. And we ended up driving around these back streets near a school in some French provincial town. And there was a guy sitting on a deck chair, you know, outside the front, in his front garden, in a vest and his pants, reading L'Équipe or some sports newspaper. And he just sitting there, mind his own business. And then we were looking for directions or trying to study the map or whatever. And this car pulled up right outside his gate. And you think back, what was he have thought that day? There he was on a quiet Tuesday afternoon, whatever it was. And it turned out he was a rally fan. And he said, "That looks just like, it's such a good replica. It looks just like the car that I was watching on television at the weekend, you know, from Catalonia." I said, "No, it is. It's the same one. It's the same clutch." we think back to that one. I don't have actually a full collection of back issues of Rally Access, but that I did find that one recently. I spotted it recently on eBay and I bought it. just because I do have some nice prints that we did, Anton Watts. I've got some of them framed, because that of all the features I've ever done, that was Andrew and I really cherished that one. It was a special time. Yeah. You learn little things, little foibles, little knocks and bumps and, you know, rattles that it had and so forth. And they kept it fairly, you know, we really weren't encouraged to turn the anti-lag on and that sort of stuff. They tried desperately to keep us from putting it into stage mode. But occasionally your hand would slip and then the radio would go off and come in. They would, you know, you look in the rearview mirror and there's no sign of the people carriers, and you think, go on then, off we go. And then we were linked by radio, you know, and you'd hear this, hello, Rally One, could you, you know, put the switch back into route mode? We can hear you from 3 kilometres away. You know? that was a fun thing. And again, I think it's the sort of thing. I've seen features since. I know M-Sport have done some where they've given the Fiesta to journalists and they've driven them around, you know, the streets of Cumbria and that sort of thing. And they're very interesting. That driving it from, you know, just down the road from Barcelona all the way to Milton Keynes was quite an undertaking.
That was crazy. Like, if you think, like any rally car isn't a pleasant place to be at any time.
Oh, no, we loved it. No, we loved it. Absolutely loved it. You can't not love that.
I know, the discomfort and the smell and everything, like after maybe for a day or two, but I'd say 4 days, after 4 days, you must have been fairly shook at
that. Well, that was the reason Freddie made the bet, because Freddie said that on road sections it was an absolute pig. And obviously that was one of the two cars that had the transverse engine but the longitudinal gearbox, which was an MSD thing. It was in the Focus 2. So there were a lot of splines and things chattering around in the transmission. So if you were on part throttle, you could just feather it and it would keep it, it would behave itself. But then if you started lifting off at all, if you tried to just sort of coast to a halt or something, it was a lot of vibration and a lot of noise. And Freddie was insisting that this would drive us mad long before Paris, let alone Milton Keynes. But then you've got noise-cancelling headphones on and that sort of stuff. And, you know, I mean, Morris, if I asked you now, would you like to go and drive a World Rally car for 4 days all the way from Spain to England? Would you?
I'd drive it for 4 months if I'd
exactly. Of course, yeah. You would. The only time I think it came close to not enjoying myself was London. And Andrew very cannily worked out the driver swaps so that, you know, I probably drove it onto the Channel train. And then he took the next stint off the Channel. And then somewhere before London, I ended up getting back in the driver's seat and I had to drive it through central London. And that was exciting, but London traffic, I mean, it's bad, it's pretty awful. And the clutch really was starting to get bad by that point. And it was quite hot and you were sitting still in it and a lot of the time. So that was probably the only time it came close to being like a job. The rest of that trip was just a boy, you know, being a boy, yeah, and having a dream come true.
Like, imagine, you know, at a rally, when you're on a road section or whatever, we'd notice it even competing at the really back end of the field. If you pass young fans or whatever, or just locals out, you know, they love seeing it. It's just such a novelty. So imagine being on the road and seeing a full works WRC car coming towards you. You know, you'd almost, like, your man reading the paper, you'd be like, did I just see that? You know?
Well, there were people. There was certainly one time I remember a guy, like, there was a, I don't know, like a 205 or a 106 or something, went past us at a junction at Crossroads and the driver did a massive double take. And then a few minutes later, you could see him in the background overtaking stuff quite erratically to catch us up. And he'd obviously doubled back and flagged us down. And he was the clerk of the course of a local rally. And he just was blown away by the fact that this thing was in his hometown. So that was one of the times where probably the only time of the trip where both of us weren't in the car, because he said there was a stage nearby that they used for the local rally. So we parked up, he got in the passenger seat and I went to find the stage just to drive it with him, just because we weren't in any particular rush to get anywhere. And it seemed like a nice thing to do for the guy who was just a complete rally nut. And that was another time that the thing the pan must have slipped on the ambulance.
I did say it, but yeah, exactly. Brilliant. Oh man, that's a fantastic story. Like, just can't even begin to imagine it happening now. I know you say that, you know, obviously M-Sport have done a few bits and pieces around the locality, but to drive something, you know, halfway across Europe, I just, yeah, that's a fantastic story. Like, looking at the championship and like the drivers involved at the time, obviously with the UK, you had, you know, the McRae and Burns rivalry. Looking at the, if you were to read the, this was more the mainstream media from the time, and look at the coverage and stuff, the rivalry was quite hyped. Did you find that was the case in reality, or, you know, was it similar to the way Granham and Burns were? Was there a bit of playing to the cameras or playing to the media for?
I think there was definitely a bit of playing to the media. I didn't really discern much. You know, they didn't dislike each other. They're very different people than, very different characters. From a professional perspective, I always got along much more comfortably with Richard than I did with Colin. Actually, I got on very well with Jimmy and Margaret, but Colin, as a journalist, the guy himself could struggle to explain how good he was or why he was good, and that made him very hard to report on. He, all those tales are generally true. Of certainly when Colin and Carlos were in the same team, and Carlos would spend the entire morning, best part of the day, in fact, going through every single possible permutation on suspension and tire choice and transmission, and end up back where he started from a lot of the time. And Colin would then turn up, get in the thing, and just go half a second a mile faster, or intent, you know. But then if you ask Colin how he did that, it wasn't that he just didn't know. He was just so natural at it that I just got in and drew it more quickly. That would be his reply. That's fine the first time, but as a journalist, it becomes quite hard to report on that as time goes on. Richard was a bit more analytical about things, probably worked at things a bit harder, like Carlos did, and maybe not to quite the same extent, but certainly did want to go through every permutation, understand stuff a lot more. And that meant when it came to relaying information about what was going on and why things had happened and why things might be better or worse, then generally speaking, he would be a better person to get that information out of. As for the rivalry, I don't think they really saw each other as any more of a rival than they did anybody else. I don't think Colin thought of Richard as any more of a rival than he did Carlos or Marcus or Tommy. But when it came to GB time, I suppose their profile rose anyway, because mainstream media tended to wake up a bit and realise that there was an event going to happen, and they wanted an angle. And you've got these two Brits who, let's be honest, their record in Wales, the Forest, was pretty sensational. So it was quite easy to pitch them against each other in that respect. And you had that sort of, you know, Colin the mercurial with all the flair. You had, you know, Richard, the much sort of quieter, more introspective guy. They were, you know, in different teams. It was relatively easy for them to build that up, I think. Colin did play to it occasionally. I think he had quite an impish sense of humour, which Richard had, but Richard sort of separated it more. Colin would let it come in a bit. So I think it was in 2002 when Colin got the T-shirts made, he got Jim Bamber, the Autosport cartoonist, to draw a fairly derogatory cartoon of Richard, when Richard was cleaning Colin's boots or licking them clean or something. And Colin proudly announced to the service park, you know, that anybody, he'd had a run of these T-shirts done, and if anybody managed to get Richard to sign it, then they could have one for free. And Richard had people coming up to him asking them to sign these things, which was just a pure wind-up thing. Colin would have thought of doing that. I don't think Richard ever would. In that, you know, Richard would have had a separate conversation with Colin and probably had a bit of Mickey taken out of him, but it wouldn't have brought it into that realm, whereas Colin would. But that aside, I don't think there was much extra there. You know, if you were, frankly, if you look at where Colin's career was slightly ahead of Richard's timing-wise, you know, the guy he really wanted to beat was Tommy Mäkinen, I think, and failed to do so for a number of seasons. So I think the period whereby Colin knew he was absolutely day in, day out, the fastest guy in the championship, I think that passed actually relatively quickly. And he was, and he probably realized that too. And I think he, not that he doubted his own ability, but I think he realized where he was, that he was amongst other very, very good drivers at the same time, and learned to cope with that. And Richard was one of them, but not the one, if that makes sense.
I think there's actually a brilliant feature you guys did where Burns and McRae interview each other. It's fantastic. It's worth digging out. And Russell Bulgin, another phenomenally talented writer, one of my absolute heroes from a journalism point of view.
A big rally fan too, Russell. Big rally
was,
fan.
He was phenomenal. I absolutely adore his work. It's a huge inspiration to me. He did an interview with Tommy in the same issue. So I'll take a picture of the cover. I'll link it on the tweet whenever we release the podcast. But if you can find a copy in eBay, it's well worth taking out. It's brilliant. You worked as well on a book for M Sport during the 2001 season, John.
Yeah, I think it must have been Haymarket, which was the parent company of Rally Access and Autosport and so forth. Obviously, we're always on the lookout for commercial opportunities. And that particular run that Colin went through in the middle of that season in 01, where he won three on the bounce, there was a genuine feeling that there was momentum behind M Sport and Ford, and that this really was going to be the year where they were going to win the world title. So a guy called Peter Fubister, who was a former Rallies editor and editor and then publisher of Autosport, pitched, knew Malcolm very well, Malcolm Wilson, and pitched the idea to Malcolm, and Malcolm went for it. So it actually was a piece of contract publishing. Haymarket was paid by M Sport to produce it. It was nominally under the directorship of a guy called Duncan Spires, who was a very talented designer, who has since gone on to work in retail and marketing and really high-end stuff. He pulled in a lot of really great photographers, but in the core of it all, they needed somebody who A, knew what one end of a rally car was from the other, and B, knew Malcolm reasonably well and could manage that side of the relationship. So I got dragged into it. So in the middle of all that calendar that you were referring to earlier on with 90-something odd flights, whatever it was, about two-thirds of the way through the year, suddenly fell on my lap that I was going to produce this book as well. And it did nearly drive me to the brink, I have to say. Mainly because Malcolm was the first time they'd done anything like that. And bits of it were phenomenally open. So I spent, you know, a week at one point just staying up in Cockermouth. We had a still life photographer, and I could just wander into the parts department. I was given free rein, could wander right into the parts department at M Sport and point at something and ask what it was and what it was made out of, and they would tell me. And I would just take it upstairs. There was still a lot of spare space at Dovenby in those days, and we just took a room and set it up into a full photographic studio. And the guy would take 2 or 3 hours to photograph one component. But also because it was the first time Malcolm had been involved in it as well, there were times where there was editorial guidance that I was trying to give him that might not have fallen in line with exactly what he wanted. So I know for a fact we had a number of discussions about whether or not to include Günter Steiner in it. One photographer had gone to us to M Sport to photograph a number of key individuals, again, properly set up, full portrait studio. At the time, Malcolm was looking obviously at how many pages we had and said that he'd give the list. I suggested Günter might be in there. He said no. And that was that. And then I think about a week before it was due to go to press, which was just the week after Rally GB in 01. And so the week before Rally GB, Malcolm came down to the Haymarket offices and we laid the entire book out around the full length of the boardroom table in PDF proofs for Malcolm to go around. And he walked around the entire table and just looked at me and went, "I've got to have Günter, haven't I?" And I got to throttle him. So we had to send a photographer up to Wales to the shakedown for Rally GB to get a shot of Gunter. But to this day, I look at it in the book and it jars me because it's not the same style as all the other photo markets. Well, anyway, it was a really cool thing to do. And they produced a regular edition and a dust jacket, and then they did a really limited one, I think 250 copies or maybe 500 at a push. It's in an acrylic, I'll send you a picture of it, Mars, but it's in an acrylic case with an open panel in the front of it, and the open panel has the M-Sport logo laser etched on metal by the equipment at M-Sport with your name on it and the number of the book. I seem to remember there's about four number ones because they wanted everybody who was important at four to have number one and Malcolm wanted number one. It's very rarely seen, actually. It was sold, I think M-Sport used to sell it themselves, the regular version of it, for a while, and it sold out. And once that run was done, that was it. It was never reprinted. And it is quite glossy, and it's a bit of customer publishing. But actually, there's a lot of really, if you like rally cars, there's some beautiful photography of just bits of the Ford Focus WRC. It was as much a star as the people, in some ways, and was treated as such. And these days, it tends to go for 70, 80, 90 quid when you see it on eBay now, which is amusing because I've got about five of them tucked in a box here somewhere. But it was a great project to be involved in. Yeah, very tough, and pushed me, as I say, right at the end of that season, because obviously I had a championship showdown to deal with as well. So and the build-up to all of that. And at the same time trying to finish the book off. But it was a good way to end what was a thrilling season, which could have been any one of three or four drivers could have won that title, you know. And who's to say if Colin had actually made it to that running order selection point in Australia at the end of day one, maybe that book would have been as intended a celebration of M Sport winning the championship, because it would have put Colin in a much better road position in Australia. And from there, it wouldn't have surprised me if he'd won or certainly got second place in Australia. And then he would have been in a much stronger position going into Rally GB and wouldn't necessarily have had to take the risks that, as we all know, he took on that final day, on that sort of final event, first morning of the final event.
It's really interesting about the M Sport book. It's when you mentioned it earlier on in the week, it's to be honest, the first I'd heard of it. So I must try and get a look at that at some point.
They did two in the end. I think they did a follow up, which Anthony Peacock, who replaced me at Rally Access, Anthony looked after that for them, I think. Malcolm just liked them. I think they were good. He'd always got an eye for the corporate side. It's good to put on the beyond senior Ford management's coffee tables and that sort of thing. And Haymarket, very good at doing it. Like I say, it was a nice team working on that, with good photography and a great design team. And I've, you know, text wise, it's fairly sparse. But there's a lot of interviews with key people and so forth. And it was just an insight really into, there's a lot of stuff about Davenby, early plans for it and how they moved in there, and got aerial photography done of it. And yeah, it's if you like that era of rally car, of rally machinery, it's worth checking out if you can find one.
Let's try and find one of those for sure. I mean, again, this is just another example of, I suppose, the amount of atmosphere around this era. Like, if you look at the coverage, obviously you had the specialist publications like Autosport, Motorsport, yeah, News, and their equivalents in other countries as well. You had Rally Access as well, a dedicated WRC magazine. You had the TV coverage. You had, for the first time ever, an officially licensed PlayStation game for the championship.
Don't forget too that Rally Access was also produced in different languages. There were four.
Oh, yeah, good point, actually. Yeah.
Which had a mixture of local content and they would take stories and translate them.
Oh, very good. Yeah, I totally forgotten about that. I remember seeing it in the odd issue that showed the covers of other countries' issues or whatever. But like, and then you had, I suppose, the mainstream element as well, like we talked about, with, you know, the UK drivers being at the forefront. And you had massive manufacturer involvement. You had, you know, iconic events. You had spectacular cars with seven manufacturers. I mean, like, and the drivers themselves, you had that great mix of the icons from in some cases, the 80s into the 90s, and then the new breed coming on, like Loeb, Solberg, Macca Martin, those guys. I think it's yet to be bettered. I really do. I think this was one of the absolute purple patches for the sport. What in your opinion, like, having been there at the time, would you tend to think the same? And was there a sense at the time that it was something special, or was it almost like just building on what had been previously?
It's very tempting. I mean, you could call it rose-tinted spectacles looking back, I suppose. I certainly think, obviously, it peaked around then for a while at least, because then undoubtedly went through a tough time in the middle of the noughties. I think there was a period in the sort of early 90s where it was getting quite strong too, you know, when Mitsubishi and Toyota and Lancia and Ford were all at it. And those cars are pretty awesome to watch as well. There's something I saw recently, somebody's been putting up a load of 1993 stuff of Kankinen in car, and you forget what a beast of a car. That's, what is there, an ST185, and it's on the RAC, I think it is, and it's just absolute handful, you know.
Just looks like a pig.
Absolute, yeah. It's just trying to kill him at every single possible.
Every time he touches the brake, it just skews off sideways.
Goes sideways. And so that was a good era too, I think. Peak Group B, I suppose. Perhaps. I just think in 01, you had such a, if you look at the depth of quality that was there, and as you said, there were a number of very well-established guys right at the top of the game. You know, Mackinnon was still there going strong in 01, you know, a four times champion. Peugeot in their pomp, Ford trying like hell with Colin. Carlos still there. You know, that year, even in 01, it was what, 8 winners in 14 rallies. That's a pretty strong number. But to have 8 people who are capable of winning a rally on any, you know, might be on a preferred surface, maybe in the right conditions. So you've still got to hang it together for 3 days with that depth, that quality of field behind you is pretty impressive. Is it the strongest of all time? Oh, I don't know. It's got to be close, Morris. I think it has to be close. And I think it's fascinating that you've picked that year, because not many other people have really raised it. But I know you're, deep down, I know you're not alone, because I think when you actually look back at that quality and the cars, they made great noises, they went sideways. You know, even on tarmac, they went sideways. You had volatile Frenchmen who hated each other in the same team. Loeb up and coming. You know, Solberg was coming on, starting to come on strong. 01 was his first podium. You know, and when you consider where he'd been, you know, even 18 months earlier, he was a broken man. Absolutely broken man. I knew Petter quite well from early on. We were basically the same age. And when the whole transfer to Subaru from M-Sport went through and the sort of the contractual wranglings, that troubled him quite deeply. I certainly remember his first day being shown around a pro drive. They were all preparing to have an evening out, and he ended up inviting me to come up and have dinner with him near Banbury because he just wanted to, virtually, the guy was almost in tears. Because he was a really young guy who'd been given his big chance and all of a sudden it had all been torn apart left, right and centre by what he wanted to do, what he, you know, conflicting emotions even within himself. So you look at where he had been even 18 months ago and then to be a point where he's starting to score podiums. He's coming on strong too. And then you've got, if you've got Loeb and Solberg both coming on good in that season, it's hard to pick. It's hard to think of any other year that mixed, that had that mix of people absolutely at the top of their game. You know, the Grundholms, the Burns, McRae, Mackinnon, seasoned pros who are still 99% there, ultra consistent, so the Carlos Sainzes. The specialists, Dulacre, Panizzi, and then the young guns starting to come through, Solberg and Loeb. That's a hell of a lineup. And then from the left field, you've still got people like, you know, Robin Perrin, you know what?
Robin Perrin, Sweden, and like, yeah. As we've seen throughout the year, he put in some cracking performances and was unlucky even to not win Finland in a way. So he actually was an outside shot at the title for a period, you know, yes. Which again just ties into the whole, I suppose, unpredictability of the year. It was all to play for.
And it was the first win for the Zara World Rally Car that year as well, right? Because Pyrrhus won in San Remo.
Corsica. Another spoiler alert. We left.
Oh, sorry, folks. But yeah. You know, that was that they were. You think that's another thing you have to bear in mind as well when you watch Loeb getting that result in San Remo. They were massively the underdogs in PSA, per Citroën. And it had taken quite a bit of lobbying to get to that point, an enormous amount of infighting. So there was real needle, you know, and in fact, I remember certainly Corrado Provera at Persia being really quite relieved whenever Panizzi won in San Remo, and it would have just been quite hard for him to take that they'd been beaten by Citroën. So everyone thinks now of Citroën as that dominant, not the rubbish team of the past 2 or 3 years in WRC, but that dominant force with Loeb, utter dominance. In 01, they were still, you know, they'd won with the kit car back-to-back, but with the World Rally car, they were still finding their feet. So that's another, again, there's another transitional point of this year, is that they've got, you know, by time you get to Corsica, they've really got San Remo too, obviously with Loeb, but they've really got the four-wheel drive car working. So they are a force. By the end of this season, they're a force.
It's funny to note that I think we mentioned it in the Catalonia episode, that the Citroën WRC program, as we know it, very nearly didn't happen, as you say, because of the infighting. Yeah. They had a prototype car running in 1999, and it was destined at the time to sit inside the museum and become just another footnote in their history.
Yeah, I had a run in that car, actually. There was a day, because they were lobbying so hard to in marketing terms, to get PSA to allow them to do it. They held a day at Sattery, which is their, you know, their headquarters, which they share. I think it's like a military testing facility, but there's a sort of a couple of kilometer test track, and they had Bruno Thierry took me for a run in the Zara kit car, which that would be in the top five as well, just because of the car, which was just utterly phenomenal. The top corner, I remember that test track, is quite a tight hairpin, left hand hairpin, and the surface is really quite broken, and he just mashed the throttle in this thing just with a mixture of, you know, an incredibly trick diff and a state-of-the-art traction control system, just put everything down and off we went, revving to God knows what. But the same day, Bogalski took us out for a run in the T4, as it was called then, which was originally called the T4, the Zara Rally World Rally Car. And then it became something, I think they called it briefly, was it something, a regional rally car it was going to be called? RRCs, they were designed. The FIA.
They ran it in France in 2000, and it, yeah. the main French championship 2000, again to build the, I suppose, get a lot of miles on, under their belt and get the development out of the way. RRC moniker.
That's right, because there was no provision in the French championship up to that point to run WRCs, I think it was. So they created this RRCs, which were basically the same, to allow them to do that. But all the while, Guy Fréquelin was really pushing like crazy for PSA to allow them to go and do the WRC. So you're right, it was there were faltering, stuttering steps, and every opportunity they got, they had to take it. They absolutely had to grab it. I think they also, was it around that time they did the non-championship running of Deutschland as well?
It would have had in 01 as a precursor to the 02, it joining the championship in a full capacity in 02, yeah.
Because I remember people being nearly injured in the press office in the first year when it was in the championship, when we realized that the online bookmakers hadn't studied the form from the non-championship year. So I'm trying to think who the two drivers were.
Bogalski won it in 01, I think. I think it was the only car, but in 02, Loeb had the Wox car and Bogalski the Wox car as well.
So they had the two Citroens. They had Loeb at 40-1 and Bogalski at 33-1. And I think I got a holiday out of that. I think I put on as much as I could possibly afford on both of them each way. And Seb had quite a close battle with Bernsey, but ultimately won. And Bogalski came in third. It was easily my best payday of 2002. Certainly way better than I ever heard writing about it, that's for sure.
I think if that was Loeb's first official win at world level. He'd won on the road in Monte and in 02, and the stupid error there with a tire change or something in a non-control zone or something like that, and he got a time penalty. But I remember, I still have that on VHS, that's how long ago it is, at home. But I just recall Burns congratulating Loeb, and Loeb, it didn't faze him at all. It was as if he just, most guys, I remember Solberg's first win, and even his title win, he just went nuts. He was so passionate about it. Whereas Loeb, obviously he was still pleased about it, but it was almost like another tick in the box. It was like, okay, now here's the first win out of the way. Now here comes 80-odd more.
Exactly.
It was crazy. He was so cool. Nothing seemed to faze him. That's really just some actually really, really good stories there. But that's fantastic. And at the moment, John, you're deputy editor of Auto Express, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I moved across. I did editor of Autosport for a couple of years after I left Rally Access. At Belion, actually, if I said I really enjoyed that stint, it was very, very F1 centric, and I struggled with that. And then I was offered the opportunity to go across to product, and I moved to Autocar, which was another magazine I'd read when I was a boy. And I spent a lot of time then, I've been doing that for about the past 15, 18 years now. So I did Autocar, did Whatcar, and then a few years ago moved across publishing houses, and so I work for Dennis Publishing. So Auto Express is the UK's best-selling weekly car magazine, and an important website as well. It's another big important part of the business. So I test cars these days, and I don't have too much to do with rallying. I watch from afar, and went up to GB. I have a young son, took him up to GB to watch. Last year, which was good because he's a big, he calls him Crisp Meek, he calls him. As I went to see, he was desperate to see Crisp Meek in action, so luckily we managed to sneak that one in before the end of the season. And funny enough, I did speak to Chris a few weeks ago because I did a feature for Auto Express where, as so many titles are, we're trying to fill pages in lockdown without access to cars, and in fact, the sports page was sadly lacking. Once everything's cancelled, you can't really say there's no more news if something's not cancelled. still cancelled. So so we've been doing motorsport memories. So I actually rang Chris up out of the blue and had a nice chat with him about winning Finland and still the fastest ever win at WRC level. And since then he said he's a very good person, has been a very good person to deal with from a journalist side. Just again, quite articulate and able to put emotion into words. And I think that story's actually, people can look it up, it's online now, the guys have put it on the website, but there's some really nice stuff at the end, the fact that there's bits where he talks about a corner on the first morning of first proper morning of Finland that year, I think it's Mäkipää, where he'd gone off coming the other way in a previous year. And he talks about sitting on the line thinking, because the corner's either fourth gear or fifth gear. He's not sure which. And he's sitting there on the line thinking, what's it going to be, Chris? Fourth or fifth? And he kept it in fifth and got round okay. And then he talks a lot at the end about just sitting on the bed, actually, having won, an event that Burnsy never won, the Column never won. No Britain had won it before. And he talks about, sorry, my son's just joined us here, sorry. He's talked about sitting on the bed and just thinking, the phone buzzing with people saying, you come to the bar. And just standing and looking at the ceiling and occasionally looking across and seeing the trophy. And I just thought as a driver, you don't hear a driver talking about that sort of experience very much. I got sucked in. I certainly got sucked in watching WRC Plus and All Live and so forth. And that morning, that Saturday morning in Finland where it was on Empoja starting, and I remember, the first thing I did when I got up and I woke up was check the mobile phone, because I thought he had pegged the measure of Latvala on the Friday, and I thought, this is where Latvala's really going to go for it. This could be a heartache here, or it could be a ball of scrap. Because, let's be honest, it was Chris, and it did happen from time to time. And then when I saw the time coming through, I just thought, that's it. Game over. He's annihilated. I think I pretty much said in the story not expressed, but there were still a lot of stages to run, but the rally was over.
Yeah.
Really was over on a Saturday morning. And, you talk about that Deutschland being dominant. That Finland, the guy was in complete control from, most of the Friday. It was closer, admittedly. But then stamping his authority on one stage, which, is still one of the best bits of onboard footage you will ever see. There was nothing left in that car.
Nothing. And Paul Lagle on the notes just put in a blinder as well. Everything worked together so good there. Like, Chris on his day was better than the best in the world. On his day. I think a fair kind of assessment. He could just have these performances where he would blow everyone away. Unfortunately, he didn't. He was never able to, in this era, maybe in a different era, he might have been champion, but again, one of the sports great, I suppose, question marks, unfortunately.
Sure, and a great entertainer, though. You've got to, bear in mind that we love it because it's a spectator sport, right? So if it's one of those ones there's always an extra little bit of excitement when somebody like him comes down the road, because it's going to be at a slightly different angle, or, you just know he's going to be trying to go absolutely as hard as the car can go. In the same way that, for example, Colin would have been too. There was always that extra bit of electricity in the air when he knew he was coming past.
Definitely. That's been a brilliant chat, John. Really, really enjoyed that. I'm sure our listeners will as well. Some fantastic tales there from, as we've said, one of the golden eras of the sport. And we'll be sure to get some more people that were involved on at the time very, very soon. So John has obviously with Auto Express, they have their own podcast, so be sure to check that out as well. So some good content on there. So just for myself, John, thanks very much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really, really enjoyed that. So thanks for taking the time to come on.
Anytime.